Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, welcome back everyone. Good to see you all again. So we're going to go through part two. Let's just do a quick review of some of the things that we discussed in part one. I just want to expand on one thing which we spoke about last week and go over the other. So we spoke a lot about praise last week. I just want to restate. I know I had a series of events this week where my children received as a gift from my parents, I forget, magnets? They're these
magnets.
Yes. So they love them. They're playing with them all day long. And so every time... That's just from last week, just for anyone who didn't get. So they play with them all week long. If you're not familiar with these things, they build all sorts of interesting things from these magnets, and they're very creative. And every time I would come home, there'd be some new, fascinating-looking contraption on the floor, and I would always catch myself saying, "Wow, that's awesome!" And it wouldn't catch... And then, okay, let's see. I see triangles and squares and floors and... It really getting into the habit, which is so easy to fall out of just evaluating it as opposed to actually describing what it is that you would see. And I was able to see the difference in their response when you do that. I had cards also that they were coloring on, and so I was describing it, and you could see between my 5-year-old and my 2-year-old how they would then, as I would describe it, each one would then throw the other one, "What about this? And what about this?" And there's a real thrill that a child gets out of having a parent actually just describe what it is that they're doing. Anybody have any similar experiences? Anybody work on this particularly, those who were here last week?
Yeah, last night there was a thing for Abraham's class, meeting a new teacher, and she had to write a letter to your child. And so I read, he had a fable that he wrote on his desk, so I started writing, "I really liked your fable because," and then elaborated on what the details of what I liked about it.
Excellent. Excellent, excellent. It's a difficult skill to learn, and I just wanted to start with this again, just to stress the significance of being able to describe, descriptive praise.
Yeah, my daughter, I thought about you, she brought me a drawing. She's in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Oh, it's beautiful," and I really meant it. And she's just downtrodden, you know. And, mm-hmm. and I said, and I started describing things about her, face lit up. And I was like, "Wow, this is like magic."
It really I did not work that out with him beforehand. It's true in every home. Every child will bring home a drawing. Every child will they do drawings. That's what children do. And to be able to describe the colors, I see shapes and colors. It really is just an amazing, it's an amazing experience. The second thing I just wanted to go over, we left off describing the idea of describing children's emotions and feelings as you see it. I see someone who's really angry, I see someone who's really happy, and naming them. I just want to just go over that point and stress something. Many of you may have heard of something called imago therapy. Anybody hear that? What it is in marriage therapy, as one spouse says whatever they say, the other spouse, instead of responding to it, repeats and says, "What you said was," and then you sort of just repeat it in your own words to let your spouse know that you really got it and you understood what it was that they were saying. And it's a whole therapy, a whole theory within dealing with that. Whether you're in favor of that or not in favor of that is aside the point. When it comes to a marriage, where very often when you're dealing with two adults, the other adult does not necessarily appreciate having their words parroted back to them. Sometimes it works. When it comes to children, they, especially the age bracket that we're dealing with, between 2 and 8, they actually don't necessarily know what it is that they're feeling. They don't have the words for the frustration or the anger, the jealousy, the disappointment, all of those different emotions which they're experiencing when they really wanted to play outside and it started to rain, or they really wanted... whatever it was that they wanted. And it's actually very helpful to a child to have a grown-up say to them, which your spouse might find condescending, if you say, "Oh, you look angry." They know that they're angry. They don't necessarily need you to say that to them. But your child does. Your child actually will grow and appreciate hearing an adult say to them, "That sounds really frustrating that you really wanted to do that." I had to, again, I don't have to make this stuff up. I just lived my life and I have thousands of examples. We had this week on a Monday, or must have been Monday because it's Wednesday already somehow. Mm-hmm. On Monday, so it was raining. So I was in charge on Monday. My wife had gone to teach at school already. I had to take my two little ones to preschool. I have a five-year-old who just had her birthday this week, and a two-and-a-half-year-old. So Dad's in charge. So we're right away, you know, late, trying to get everything together, and the lunches, and the backpacks. And I found my five-year-old's raincoat, and I couldn't find the two-year-old's raincoat. So now this is a problem. I need to come up with something because I wouldn't want to send my child to the preschool without like any form of coat. So I found one of the children's umbrellas. So I said, fine, get into the car, already running late. I get everybody into the car, and as they're getting into the car, my five-year-old discovers that while she has to be wearing a raincoat, the two-year-old has an umbrella. And right there in the car, without getting into the car seat, total meltdown. Now, I'm already running late. I'm like barely hanging on, getting everybody into the situation, and now I have my five-year-old and my two-year-old in the car. No one's getting to the car seat because my five-year-old's having this horrific experience of, it's not fair that he gets an umbrella. Now, what are our options? I'm just making, none of this would happen to any of you and your families, for sure not. So I'm just describing as a practice exercise. What are our options with five-year-old having a meltdown in the car because she has her raincoat, which she doesn't apparently want, even though she wanted to wear it 3 minutes ago, but now she doesn't because two-year-old has an umbrella. What are our options?
Duct tape,
excellent, right? Duct tape, which would go along the lines of shoving her into a car seat and holding her down while we get it all buckled in and told you. That's for sure an option. And if that works for you, that's great. I have seen parents pull into the preschool who have tried that, and they are frazzled. That's an option. The other option is to begin to reason with her, and you can explain. No, well, sweetheart, you see, really, he needed his raincoat too. I couldn't find his raincoat, so I had to go there. Well, you could try that. What chances of success of that? Zero. The other option?
Give her an umbrella.
Excellent. Right? We can drop everything, change plans, back into the house we go, and dig up a second umbrella because the five-year-old demands equality. That's an option. Now, how good of an option long-term is that?
No.
It's pretty poor. But right, Dad's standing here in the car, it's raining, I'm stuck, I got a five-year-old meltdown, so what's the response? So the response is, because I had just gone through this on Wednesday night, it was still pretty fresh, and I'm always looking for material as far as coming in this Wednesday night was, oh, Rena, you really wanted an umbrella too? Yes, and you're so sad that you have to wear a raincoat and he gets to wear have an umbrella, and that's so unfair. Yes, what do you think we can do about this? She says, maybe next time I can have an umbrella. I said, fantastic idea. Maybe next time you'll get the umbrella. And guess what? Problem was solved. She was like, grown-up figure, was able to get into, and again, I was just said that really quickly, but I was like, oh, like if you actually feel it with a child, like you're so sad that this, and you wish that you could have this, and then provide them a chance. What do you think we can do about this? And little five-year-old comes up with a creative solution, well, maybe next time. In 2 seconds, they were in their car seat. You don't even believe me.
Mine would say, I want that umbrella.
Okay, so
now.
Okay, that's fine. Now. So you say, so then you repeat that. You really want to have that umbrella now and not wear your raincoat, right? So fine. So now you're with that.
Mm-hmm.
And now, does she have an option of getting the umbrella? No, she can't because you only have one. So once you've gotten into that place where she really wants it now, and you could say, just continuing that train of thought in the sense of, I know you really want to know, what do you think you want to switch, or let her work out.
Right.
Give them the opportunity where you're with them and you understand their sadness. I'm telling you, just be there with them. Mm-hmm. Give them the chance. They'll come up with solutions. It's really, we're so used to the combative right away, explaining to them, or the no, or the forcing them, that they really, children are so resilient, they respond so well. Try it. Just give it a shot. Come back next week and tell me.
So, we've been trying that. With one of our children, 10, 15, 20 minutes later, it's so full-blown tantrum.
Okay, so
there is no coming up with her own solution. There is just, she's just not bad.
So So tonight, now I mentioned last night that I like to deal with two major theories and putting them together. So one, which was last week's Faber-Maslow, which we discussed, if you weren't here, take a listen online, which deals a lot with getting into their feelings and where they are, talking to them in a certain way. So tonight we're going to do the love and logic,
okay.
Which is how we respond. It's much more of a behavioral approach, how we respond in certain circumstances. Each one, as I said last week, would view themselves as all that you need. If you read their books, listen to their lectures, each one is independent. I personally take a combination of both, and I think where I would shift personally, if I had that situation, is then it's a little bit of the both. It's sometimes where a child doesn't necessarily respond to that, and then now what? That's where this will come in. So let's use it as our segue into a little bit of love and logic. Now, again, as I said, love and logic is a theory. It's what's the guy's name? Clive and Fay, I think Jim Fay and something Clive. There, you can Google them. They have tons of books on all sorts of different approaches. I forget their name. I have their book in my office. It's an approach. It's if you read Love and Logic or you listen to the lectures on it, it's a world view. I am not trained in it, and I don't believe in it personally. It's a little harsh as an entire worldview. As a tool, I find it just phenomenal. It's as we'll go through, there are circumstances where you're going to want to have this, you will use it, you will find it immensely successful as an approach as to how to deal with things. If you really like it, you could take it upon yourself as a life goal, and you could live your life that way. That's totally fine. I personally don't. I use it as a combination of what we did last week and this week, and I present it that way, but it is more than what I present. I just state that I don't want you to think that what I'm doing is indeed love and logic. If a love and logic person would be here, they would say, you're not giving the whole picture, and I'm telling you up front, I'm giving you as a tool, as I have found it successful for myself. If you like it, look more into it and take it on more. Okay. The general approach is, what do we really want from our children as they grow up? And that's the concept of being independent and making their own wise choices. You know, obviously we want a lot of things for them, but we could say, we want them to be independent. We want our children to grow up and leave. We actually want that. And I know this is like a 2 to 8 year session, so you're like thinking, that's really what we want. We want our children to grow up and get out of the house. That will be success. They will be independent. They will be responsible. They will be capable of making their own decisions. And we as parents will feel we've given them the opportunities to learn and grow about the world around them, and they will make wise choices. And in order for them to get to that point, so then we have to actually give them a training ground where they can experience what it's like to make decisions. A famous psychological study that was done, I'm sure you've heard of it, the Stanford marshmallow example, in which children are presented, it's been done in many different forms. Children are given a marshmallow in front of them with a choice of, you can either eat this marshmallow now, or if you wait, the variation of the test would be 15 minutes, you can have two. And then they measure how do children respond to such a scenario. I can have a marshmallow now, or if I wait. So some children are too young to understand that concept. If you would ask a 2-year-old that question, the idea of waiting 15 minutes, what does 15 minutes mean? Well, I'll take that marshmallow now, and then I'll ask for two right now when I finish the first one. They're beyond that type of exam. But then as a child grows older, and they begin to mentally understand what it means to wait, and they begin to contemplate the value of now versus more later. And they've done studies, and there's many variations of this study. It's been quoted many times, and many others have done different variations of it, as the concept of studying delayed gratification versus strategic reasoning, however you want to view the object of the study, but what child as they develop at different stages. And what we really want as children, this is really how we live our lives, is I want something now, I have something now, and we have to learn, is it worth it now? Is it better to wait? And we have to learn, how do we help our children along this path of understanding decision-making and the consequences of the decision? Well, you took the marshmallow now, so now you don't get any later. That's the consequence of the decision that you made. Versus weighing that. So we can provide them an arena in life in which children can understand they make lots of choices in life, and the choices that they make are going to have consequences. Not necessarily punishments, consequences. You made a choice. This is the consequence of that choice. And while the costs are relatively low, because they're 2 years old and 4 years old and 6 years old, and the costs of the choices that they make might simply be they didn't have time to read a book before they went to bed, or a homework assignment was turned in late in fourth grade, which is a relatively low cost. They learned that lesson that there are choices, there are decisions that they make, and it will impact them so that when they become teenagers and they go for their job interviews and then grow up, they already have been prepared, and we as parents can feel confident as they leave that they've had that opportunity. We want them to be problem solvers. Now, I have here in the notes a line, which is true, and all of you will realize from your own work environments. Who is the only person who will ever solve a problem? The person who owns the problem. If we want our children to become problem solvers, we have to allow them to become the owners of their problems. If a child doesn't own their problem, meaning mommy or daddy are always there to fix and to help and to deal with whatever issue that they're dealing with, then they will never learn to problem solve because they don't have to problem solve. Who's doing it for them? We are. You know, they call them helicopter parents. You know, lots of schools like to joke that they have helicopter pads right outside of their school because their parents landing all the time to deal with lunches that were forgotten and papers that weren't turned in and teachers that have to be complained to, and the parents are just hovering around. You see at the playground, so the parents who walk around, they follow their children around, like making sure that nothing ever happens, and they just hover. So hovering parents don't allow children to actually experience what it's like to make mistakes and to experience the consequences of those mistakes and to deal with that. So love and logic is the theory of love your child enough to allow them to make mistakes. You can love them enough to make mistakes. Because when they make mistakes, then the logic, meaning the natural consequences, let that do the teaching. You don't have to do that. You just have to be a parent and create an environment in which, in safety and in a controlled manner, you'll allow the child to live and make lots of mistakes. And it's a good thing when a child makes a mistake. I mentioned last week my earmuffs that I wear when it gets, I think it was in this session, right? My earmuffs when it gets cold. So I almost never forget my earmuffs on even, I don't want to say winter day, even when it dips below like 50 or 40 or in the 50, whatever. I'm wearing earmuffs. Why do I always check my pockets before I leave the house? Because it happens once or twice where I went out without them and my ears were frozen. So I made a mistake, I suffered the consequences, and I learned. That's how we all function. When we go on a trip to New York, we triple check to make sure that we have our Easy Pass, which is not attached to our car because we don't need it here in Georgia, but you need it in New York. Why do we triple check that we have it? Because one trip we forgot and we spent hours and hours over the course of the week that we were in New York waiting online at the toll plazas. Well, you only make that mistake once. Well, we want our children to experience the same. You could tell me a week in advance, don't forget your Easy Pass. But that won't help me. But now I'm not going to forget. I experienced what it's like not to have it. Nobody punished me. I just dealt with the consequences. And now, lesson learned. Well, that's really what we want for our children. We want them to experience life, make decisions, have the authority, the ability. We said last week, a child craves control. The more healthy control we give them, the less unhealthy control they will try to take, because they have control. They'll make decisions. They'll learn from them, and they will be able to make those decisions. Okay, let's get into the concept. It's a very simple, simple concept. It's so logical that you sort of think, well, I could have thought of this myself. And that's why I like it. That's why I teach it, because I think it is really logical. Let's start with our children. What are the things that we can control and the things that we cannot control in our children? Let's just go through this list and let's decide if we can or cannot control the following behaviors. Child is throwing a temper tantrum in the kitchen. Can we or can we not control whether or not our child throws a temper tantrum in the kitchen?
No.
No?
Unless you have a gate.
Unless you have what?
Unless you have a gate.
Yeah. A gate? Okay, let's just say, let's leave out the location. Can we control whether or not our child throws a temper tantrum?
Mm-hmm.
Anyone here ever tried to stop one? But we can, right?
I tried.
It doesn't really work very well, because really we can't. It is impossible for one human being to control another human being's, even if it's a child, because recent studies have suggested it's still true, children are very similar to regular people. You can't control them. Okay, temper tantrum. Okay, I can't do that. How about if a child takes a bath? Can you control whether or not a child takes a bath? Yes or no?
What about the temper tantrum in the bath?
Okay. Let's take one step at a time. Can you or can you not control if a child takes a bath? What do you say? Yes?
Yes.
How old are your children?
Six.
And you think you can control it?
Sure.
Okay, anyone disagree?
I disagree.
Okay, I disagree. I'll tell you why. Under like one, you can control because you just pick the child that you put in the bath. I find that when my child, who's 5, 6 or above, doesn't want to take a bath, it's a horrible fight to throw a child into a bath. So I sort of can control it, but at that age already, 4 or 5, have you ever fought with a 4-year-old in a bath? Is it a pleasant experience or an unpleasant experience?
Scary.
Right, scary, clean. So technically, I guess, yes, you can still at that age throw the child into the bath. Child who doesn't want to be bathed at 5, 4, 5, 6, I would say really you can't. I mean, for those who have fought with a child at that age, you just it's a horrible experience. And that's the experience we spoke about last week. When you go to sleep at night, you say like, that was a great day parenting. Right? If you're fighting with your child to get him into the bath, it's a horrible day. Okay, how about brushing teeth? Can you control whether or not your child brushes their teeth?
No,
no way, right? Anyone tried that? That's a disaster, right? It's a horrible experience.
Don't put your hand in there.
Right? Danger zone, right? Okay, so we agree we can't control that. How about if your child speaks to you with an attitude? Who has a daughter older than 5? Right? So whether or not you're, I don't mean to be discriminatory, sons can do it also, but boys do it in different ways. Girls somehow, I don't know, at a young age they pick up. Can you control whether or not your child speaks back to you, rolls her eyes, or gives you that look? Certainly not. Right? There's no way that we can control that. Okay, you can't do that. How about if they eat their vegetables? No? You tried that one? Right, you can't control that. Clean up. Hits a sibling, takes their toy. Like this whole list. You can't control it. How many of us have tried to control some of these behaviors before, right? So let's first start with the concept is what can we control and what can't we control? So really there's very little things that we can control in our children because children, how many things can we control in our spouses? Right? Can't control these things either. You can't control these things in anyone. Yet with children we try really, really hard because these are behaviors which they need to be doing. So we try to control them in the same way that we try to control other human beings, and it really meets with very little success. Okay, so the first step is every behavior that you see or that you're dealing with your child, think to yourself, can I control this? Can I not control it? More often than not, you will find yourself saying, I actually cannot control this behavior. I cannot force my child to do what it is that I want. Okay, well, what are the most common behaviors that we use to try to control them so we can pull them out of our repertoire and say to ourselves, anytime we catch ourselves doing this, we're heading down a path of failure and we're going to find ourselves frustrated and unsuccessful. Okay, this is in, where do I have it here so we could just go through them? What's that? There it is. Where is that? I can't find it on my thing.
After A.
Okay, so let's go through the most common approaches that we have. I'm sorry, I'm totally...
A and then the small A and then
the... Oh, there they are. Thank you. I totally got lost. Okay, now here are things that we're just going to spend a moment on this because you hear them so often in yourself, in your spouse, on the park, playground, and elsewhere. They are the most ineffective tools that we have as parents, but because we are so in the mindset of controlling behavior because we need our children to do things like bathe or eat or stop hitting their sibling. We need those things. We need them to go to bed. Can you make a child fall asleep? I've tried that one a lot of times. Is it very warm in here? I'm a little bit, should I change the setting? Is everyone okay? So we can't control those things, but we try. So we come to generally one of these 4 or 5 approaches, which is worth going through just to have in our heads to hear what it sounds like so that we can permanently delete them from our repertoire. We use threats. Now, threats generally sound something along the lines of, if you don't get in the car seat right now, we will never, ever, ever leave the house again. Something along those lines, or you will never go to a birthday party. It sounds something like that. Now, if you would actually stop and hear yourself think, you'd be like, well, that's ridiculous. Which is probably what your child is thinking. Like, right, yeah. at 2 years old, right? You made it. So a threat. Now, why is a threat a poor choice of parenting technique? Let's just talk about why is it. Let's say it worked. Let's say your child wasn't old enough to realize that you don't really mean that they're never going to eat ice cream ever again, because you took them out to ice cream and they didn't get in the car seat on the way back, and you said, "That's it. If you don't get in the car seat, we will never go out for ice cream." And they actually think you're serious. So let's say they actually get into the car seat. What's the problem with this approach, even though it worked? But it's for sure going to be inconsistent.
You're punishing yourself if you're really going to have to keep it.
Right, if you're going to keep it, or you have to say, so you mean it. So here, you're setting yourself up for a disaster. What about your relationship with your child? Right, is that the type of relationship that you want to create, in which when you want your child to do something, you hang over them with a threat? Now, what happens when the child grows up and you can't make threats like that anymore? What are we teaching our children if they do get into... Now, you're at your wit's end. You took them out to ice cream. It was a great day. And they won't get in the car seat. And you're done. And so you don't know what to do. And you're tired. And like, that's it. We will... So how have you taught your child to respond? Your child responds to... When they feel threat, why are they making the decision to get in the car seat? Because it's the right thing to do. It's in their best. It's because, right? They're afraid that they're never going to. They want to go for ice cream again. So you've created a dynamic where you're going to hold that over their head. It's not really the type of parents that you probably dreamed of being. That's what we hold over our child. Yet we often fall to threats. Children are scientists. Explorers. They want to explore. They want to do things. And to hold a threat over their head is really not necessarily a success. Let's just go through all of these. Warnings. These are one of my favorites. You hear this all the time. That's number one. That's two. Now, what's the problem with this parenting approach, which is so common that even those who swear I'll never do that will find themselves sometimes doing it. Mm-hmm. What happens? What's the problem with this? Let's just talk it, because it's so ridiculous. You need to stop yourself when you do it.
When you get to three.
Right. Well, you're not going to get to three because you're going to do 2 1/4. And then you're going to go into a math lesson. You're going to use this opportunity to teach your child math. 2 1/2, 2 5/8, 2 7/8, 2 15/16.
Don't let me
get to three. Now, it's a horrible system to get involved in. Now, the other problem is you might actually get to three, and now what? Well, your child's wondering the same thing. Well, what happens when you get to three? And then you get to three, and you're like, oh, I never figured this out. What should I do when I get to three? So usually you'll fall back on some other ridiculous thing, like, that's it, and you'll go back to, like, we're never going to have ice cream again.
Right,
and it all comes back. So I said, okay, I'm not going to do a threat, I'm going to do a warning, and then you get to three, and now I'm stuck. I'm back to the same place where I started. It's also the same approach of this. Can you imagine if you lived your life as an adult, and you had a boss who is constantly, every time they ask you to do something, they poke their head in and go, that's one, two, like, okay, I'll do it. So like you're running, it's just not a healthy environment, that it's not as you want. Okay, that's with warnings, lectures. Lectures are the best. You've seen this all the time from parents. Like, okay, and you start explaining why it is, we went out to ice cream. I work really hard, and I decided to spend that money on taking you out for a special treat. Is this how you want to treat me? Is this what you think is the right thing? Now, most children will hear that and say, oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. I totally didn't realize. You're right, I'll get into my car seat right now. Or if they're coming out of their bed at night and you start lecturing them on how important it is to have a good night's sleep, because tomorrow, you understand, you're going to be tired and cranky, you're not going to be able to learn in school. Most children respond and they say, I didn't think about tomorrow. I was just thinking about having a good idea, Mom. I'm out of here. Wake me up in the morning. So besides from the fact that children, they don't really respond that way, most children, that is, what do we as adults do when we get lectured? Correct. We tune out. We stop listening. The second we actually don't listen to the words. We hear the tone of a lecture, and as soon as we hear that tone, we're done. As adults, we don't like being lectured to. Not by our spouse. Not by our boss. Certainly not by our parents. Until this day, right? Any grown children, do we like being lectured by our parents? No. It doesn't matter that you could be 35. You could be 45. We don't like being lectured to by our parents. So guess what? Our children, when they're 3 and 4 and 5, also don't necessarily like being lectured to. It doesn't help. And if you catch yourself explaining and talking, stop right there. Anger is worth saying. You don't have to raise your hand. Most parents have at some point their parenting experience gotten angry. It happens, I know. It's rare. You've seen friends. It's never happened. Maybe you saw your spouse once get angry. It happens. Where I remember the first times that I remember thinking that I actually wanted to throw my child across the room was shocked. Okay, I can't believe I just thought that. But you do. It's really like you get so frustrated. You're so tired. You're so overworked, so hungry, so on the edge, that when the child just keeps pushing your buttons, you actually cross over into a point of just anger and total frustration. How good are we as parents when we're angry like that? Pretty poor. Mm-hmm. And you have to recognize that in ourselves. It's a real emotion. We get there. When you're there, you cannot parent. Do not try. You will catch yourself. I've once started taking notes of things that I said when I was angry, because they're the silliest, most ridiculous things. But you have to recognize in ourselves that you're angry. You cannot parent angry. You can't. Pull yourself out. Take a pause. Compose yourself. Because when you are angry, and you will get angry, and if you've never experienced that, just take my word for it. Although I doubt you don't know what I'm talking about. You can't parent. You're not a human being. Stop. Last one, bribes. Anyone ever bribed a child before? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's the problem with that parenting technique? What's that? You end up buying a lot of toys. And guess what? Children who are bribed when they're 2 turn into children who are bribed when they're 3. And children who are bribed when they're 3 turn into children who are bribed when they are 4. And guess whose tastes get more and more expensive as children go? And you find yourself in a ridiculous pattern of bribing what started off as a cute little ice cream cone, I'll take you out for ice cream, becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's not a technique. It's just a bad system to set up that causes trauma. Okay, so I've given you all the things that none of you have ever tried before, but if you have, you notice that it doesn't really work. Well, then what does work? What are we supposed to do? So that's the approach of love and logic. And that is as follows, letter E. The 4 steps. And it's all about natural consequences. Let the child make a decision. I can't control the decision that they make. I'm going to let you make the decision. I want you to be doing any of the following things: not having a temper tantrum, getting into the bath, brushing your teeth, not speaking. I want all those things. I need all those things for my home. I'm going to state what it is that's needed. The rules are going to be clear. And I'm going to let the child make their decision and then simply live with the consequences. And my job as a parent is to simply create the consequences so that the child realizes they're making decisions, and who's being impacted by their decision? They are, not the parents. When we become impacted by their decision, running around the house trying to catch them to get them into the bath or doing all sorts of other things, then the control has shifted from the parent, where it should be, to the child, who is now running the show because we're running after them, as opposed to let the child make decisions. Let them make the wrong decision. Let them make the wrong decision all the time, and learn what happens when you make a wrong decision. The consequence is yours. Not a punishment. I'm going to distinguish between that. Just a consequence. I'll take a simple example. Let's take a decision, an example. Let's go through the 4 things. Number 1 is setting firm and consistent loving limits. Cute phrase. It's firm, it's consistent, it's loving limits. Let's take an example in my house about dinner time. This probably doesn't happen in your house, but dinner time is dinner time, dinner's on the table, and nobody makes a move. Mm-hmm. All the kids are in the playroom, dinner's now on the table, and it's just dinner. No one's coming. No one's coming. Now, is this a problem or is this not a problem? Well, it's sort of a problem because they have to eat. And if they don't eat, then dinner can extend for like 4 hours. That's not an option in my house, that dinner should extend for 4 hours. Can't have that. Unless it's Shabbos lunch. That's true. That never applies to Shabbos lunch in my house because lunch never ends. That's correct. But dinner time is totally different during the week. Dinner time is totally different. So dinner has been called. They know what it is. Step 1 is simply setting the limits. Now, again, using Faber and Masters, the language, as much as possible. It could be in any type of thing. Computer is not for touching. Well, this is an example I wanted to give. I'll give an example of a young kid. My 2-year-old, this happened just this week, was having trouble slamming doors. He was angry about something or another. I actually walked into the middle of it when I got home. I don't know what he was upset about. He was upset. How does a 2-and-a-half-year-old express his anger? Slamming doors. And he was just slamming a particular door. And my wife was trying to get him to stop, but it was just one of those battles. So, okay, step in, and let's love and logic it, which would be as follows. Shai, doors are not for slamming. Policy is stated in a Faber Maslow's language, not you may not slam the door. Simply not in a use statement, doors are not for slamming. I take a step back, fully expecting the following to happen. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I'm actually hoping that will happen. Because child needs to learn doors are not for slamming. Now, he goes right ahead in my face, which I was really hoping for because I just stepped right back. Bam! Slams the door. Now, okay, what are our options as parents? So if we can go back to our old methods, we could either start threatening, we can yell, we can get really angry. That's only we can start lecturing about slamming doors. So we're not going to do any of those things. Child had a just choice to make. Doors were not for slamming, and looking me in the eye, which I was like, I'm like waiting for it, and bam. So at this point, for a young child, without any words or need to explain, child is removed from the situation. The consequence of slamming doors is you're clearly demonstrating to me you're not ready to be out near a door. So you can't be near a door. Now, this is a two-year-old. We're going to go through all the different levels as to how the theory is going to be the same for all age children, but the applications shift a little bit. We're going to focus again from 2 to 8. So my two-year-old can't get out of his crib yet.
Okay.
Two-year-old can't get out of his crib. We'll talk about older children because as soon as they can get out of the crib, then it doesn't work anymore, right? So my two-year-old, we're going to start here at the youngest age. He can't get out of his crib. So doors are not for slamming. He just slammed the door. Pick him up. Oh, I'm so sorry. I see you're not ready to be out of your room right now, and I drop him into his crib. I don't say anything. I don't explain. I don't yell. I don't tell him, don't ever slam the door. Nothing. Just say, I see you're not ready to be outside. I put him in his crib, and I walk out. He screams for a few minutes. I go back in 2-3 minutes later and say, are you ready to come back out? And he says, no. I said, great. I go back to the kitchen. I come back 2 minutes later. I say, are you ready to come out? And he says, yes. I said, fabulous. Pick him up and put him down, and I walk out with him. And he goes wherever he goes. And I'm just keeping an eye to see if he's going back to the door, which he doesn't because he's had this done to him before. He has learned that when he slams doors, and the policy is not to slam doors, who gets impacted? He does. And that's a bad choice for him. It doesn't work. Now, is it a punishment? It's similar to timeout in little kids, but it's different. It's not in the sense of a punishment. It's just a matter of, and I say it as I'm going to, I see you're not ready to be outside. I put him in his crib, and I take him out. With an older child who can climb out of his crib, it's the same thing with one very slight variation. I just bring him into the room. And we're still talking little kids. I bring him into the room, a kid you can pick up, and I say, I see you're not ready to be outside. Whenever you're ready, please come back and join us. So it's not a timeout. It's completely in the child's control and decision to come back out. But he's removed from the arena. The arena is where he wants to be. You demonstrated to me you're not ready to be here. So fine, no problem. You can't be here. Bring him into his room. And I say to him, when you're ready to come out, we'd love to have you. Now, what's going to happen to most three-year-olds when they do that?
Run right back out.
Which I'm more than happy to have. Let him come back out. I walk right behind him, and we see what happens. Well, what are most three-year-olds going to do? Exactly. And which is totally fine, because I'm just keeping an eye on it, which is exactly what I'm expecting to do, which they'll do. Because they want to see whether or not this is really the policy and the rule out. They'll slam the door again. And I say, oh, I'm so... And we're going to get to the empathy in which you really... Oh, I'm so sorry, I see you're still not ready. No problem. I pick him right back into the room. And again, I put them on their bed. I say, when you're ready to come out, we'd love to have you. Mm-hmm. What do most three-year-olds do at this point? They don't. I go home. Try it. You'll see that they're learning that they have a choice. They have a behavior they can do or can't do. And when they do it, they can't be here. They're removed from the arena, which is where they want to be. And as long as you are empathic, which we'll go through the bed, like, I feel so sorry. I love it when you're with us in the playroom. I wish you could be there, but I see you're not ready to be there now. And you put them in. They will come out, and they will do it again, usually once or twice, and then they stop. At this point, my children, I usually don't even get to my room. I almost never get there because they're done, they're finished, and they're like, it's not worth it for them. And they've learned that it's a thing with them where they know this is what's going to happen. Let's take a temper tantrum. Let's shifting to a little bit older of a child who was old enough to get out of the crib. We're going to go through a bunch of examples, and I'm explaining the concept through examples, and we'll go through other things as well. Child has a temper tantrum in the kitchen. Now, in our house, the rule is, and I would recommend this for your house, there are no temper tantrums in the kitchen. It's just, we can't manage. I can't think straight. Rivka can't work on anything that needs to be worked on. No temper tantrums in the kitchen. Now, I can't control if my child has a temper tantrum, but I can control, generally, where they have it. So in my house, the policy is not in the kitchen. Just not allowed. So, well, they don't always remember that, and they sometimes, because what they want is often in the kitchen, and what they can't have is often in the kitchen, that's where they just fall on the floor and they lose it. Or just general kvetching. So for an older child, we've created in our house a kvetch room. It's a kvetch room. Every house should have a kvetch room. This is the room where children can kvetch all they want for as long as they want. So when we have a child kvetching in the kitchen or in the dining room, or, and again, we're talking smaller children, pick them up and I say, there's no kvetching in the kitchen, but you're welcome to kvetch in our kvetch room. And I take him with me into, it's one of the kids' rooms, and you could shift around. And I say, would you like me to stay with you here while you kvetch? Or do you want to kvetch by yourself? And usually at this point, I start kvetching because I'm really good at it. And they enjoy having company. And again, I say to them, when you're ready, when you're finished kvetching, you can come out whenever you want. So it's in their control. They're welcome to come out as soon as they do, as soon as they're finished. What will most 3-year-olds do for the first time that they experience this, where their parent has picked them up and said, you are welcome to kvetch as much as you want in here. I can't stop you from kvetching, but you can't do it in the kitchen. You can kvetch in here as long as you want. When you're done, you can come out. What will most children do? They'll come right out. Well, which is great. No problem with that. Now, what do they do when they come out is the question. So you follow. And now, generally what you should do is, as they come out, is you should say, I'm so excited you're finished. That's amazing. They'll look at you like you're crazy because they're still kvetching. They run back into the kitchen, throw themselves on the floor exactly where they left off. That's what most good 3-year-olds will do. And your response as a parent is, no problem. Pick them up, and with them, oh, I see you're still not ready to be in the kitchen. We love it when you're in the kitchen, but I see you're not ready. You can kvetch in the kvetch room for as long as you want. Bring them back in, put them down on the bed. When you're done, come on out. I am telling you from experience, once, twice, and then they're done. Because they want to be in the kitchen. They don't want to be in the room. And you've given them what it takes to get there. This is where, my 2-year-old, my 3-year-old, I done kvetching, Daddy, before we get there. Mm-hmm. I say, no way, you're finished already. No, I'm finished. No, and now you don't even want to kvetch a little bit? No, I'm done. And then they're finished. It's a little bit of training. Like when they kvetch, I can't stop you from kvetching. I can only control a little bit where. And you, under most circumstances, can outlast your child. In which you'll bring them in and they'll, now I have lots of problems and questions, which is good. Well, let's just see, you had a question first. Yeah.
When you said you want me to stay in here,
mm-hmm.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
So what if you really need to be cooking in the kitchen?
Okay, so don't offer that. This is all these are slight variations in terms of you have to always deal, as we go through these examples, we're going to go through with all of the practical realities that we face, whether or not you're home alone, whether or not you have a backup, whether or not you have there's a theory. Well,
No,
all of you pick up your own things, what works for you, what doesn't work for you. I have found this extremely successful for kvetchy children. I can't control if they're going to be kvetchy. I can, at a certain age, where they do it. I bring them in, and they generally take a few minutes. Sometimes I've had children who won't stay there for a second. They come right out, but they stop kvetching because they want to be in the kitchen. And I've had children who actually will stay there and cry for 5 minutes and then come out. Different children do different things.
I took a love and logic class when my daughter was about 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I have never gotten her to stay in the room except to lock her in the room. She comes out, she follows me around, she throws herself in my path. And it is, I mean, I have this lock turned around in her bedroom door, and you know, now she's almost as big as I am. And so it's a full-out war to get her in her room and get
yeah,
the door closed and locked before she
so
can
if,
get out again.
If they're big enough, then I would use something else. In other words, this is...
I mean, I've been trying this for years, and it's
so I can't. Again, as I said, and I was like, a love and logic person would sit here and fight with you until you got it to work.
But what do you do?
So let's go through. So in other words, let's go through some of the other options, which in my mind apply to older kids, which could simply just apply to you just have a precocious child, and with some of the things which work for older children might just work for younger children. Let's get through the whole thing. It's a tool. Again, I have found at times I don't want to get too caught up with these examples because it's a much bigger natural. System. Let me go through. I know there's some questions. Hold on to your questions. Let me get through a little bit more as we get to older kids because it changes a little bit, and then we'll get to some of the questions. So basic concepts again. Give them the tool. Give them the instructions. What the policy of the house is. Wait for them to blow it, which most children will, because children are scientists. They want to explore. They want to test out. They want to see how the world works. Our children discover the world through us. Children who are, they see how we react to them, and they're learning about the world around them. So let them explore and see how it is that the world works. When they blow it, which is a significant learning opportunity, with empathy, allow the natural consequence to do the teaching. Now, with empathy means that you actually feel bad. If you are angry, or you're really gloating that you're going to get them, it won't work. I've tried that too. It doesn't work. They see right through it. They see that you're just punishing them. You actually have to be on their side, and that you really want them to be able to do what it is that they want, whether it's going with you on a certain trip, whether or not it's going to the store, eating their ice cream, whatever it may be, you actually want it for them, but you feel so bad that they can't have it because of whatever it was that they did, which is a natural consequence. Let's go through another example, which take an older child. Let's take an example, a child who's beginning to learn to go to the bathroom when you're having trouble getting them to wash their hands after they go to the bathroom. You're consistently finding this problem. You're discovering the proof that they went to the bathroom. Maybe they forget to flush the toilet as well. And they're not washing their hands. And you know that they're not because you're a parent and you can tell that they're not. Now, how do you get a child to wash their hands? So this is a problem, right? Because what are you going to force? You can try to force them. Can you control whether or not a child washes? A little bit if you could hold them and corral them. And get it's just a problem. It doesn't always work. So what do you do? Well, state the policy. After you use the bathroom, you must wash your hands. That, right? The way to go to the bathroom, they don't wash their hands. Now, what the next step is will depend on your family situation and what you can manage, what you can't manage. But you certainly can manage the following. You certainly can manage a child who doesn't wash their hands can't eat because that would be unhealthy. You agree to that? Is that a pretty natural consequence? If you don't wash your hands after going to the bathroom, I can't give you something to eat. That wouldn't be healthy for you. So that you can certainly control. Well, guess how well that works when a child comes at it. Now, if you can control their toys, that will happen even faster. That's a little bit harder to control that you're going to watch that a child. I just find that more difficult. But it's easy to control a child who's at that stage getting to food. Very simple. So there's a very natural consequence. I'm not going to run around, force you, lecture you, yell at you, or threaten you to go wash your hands. I'm simply going to state, after you use the bathroom, we wash our hands. And then, when you find that they're not, and then you don't do anything. Just wait until they ask you for something to eat, which usually should take between 3 and 5 minutes. And then you simply say, oh, I'd love to give you a snack. I can't give snacks to children who don't wash their hands. It's not healthy. Nothing more than that. Nothing more than that. Guess what you're going to find? Child who's learned, well, it pays for me to wash my hands. Now, is that a punishment that you're not giving them food? Not only punishment, that's a reality of life. It's not healthy to wash their hands after not going to the bathroom. So I'm going to create a consequence and simply without yelling, screaming, threatening, or bribing, simply say, I really would like to give you something to eat. I can't because a child who doesn't wash their hands can't have what to eat. You don't have to say, go wash your hands. You don't have to say that. Just say, a child who doesn't wash their hands can't have what to eat. Guess who's going to go wash their hands? Guess who's probably going to start washing their hands every single time they go to the bathroom pretty quickly. Yep. Take a more extreme example within love and logic theory. You're having trouble getting a child to brush their teeth at night. Anyone ever experienced that before? Right. So you run around the house, it's a disaster. Well, try the following. What would be a natural consequence of not brushing your teeth? What's the greatest concern that we have as parents for not brushing your teeth? Right. What kind of foods are the greatest cause of teeth falling out if they don't brush their teeth? Candy and sugar treats. So what's a natural consequence of not brushing your teeth is I couldn't give you candy because I need a child who eats candy has to be able to brush their teeth in order to make sure that you don't get cavities. So the it would look like this. I've done this in my house and it works wonders. Time to brush your teeth, and you walk into the bathroom and you wait for the child to come to brush their teeth obediently, and guess who doesn't come? You're a sweet little child because they're busy doing other things. You wait however you think is a reasonable amount of time for a child to come to brush their teeth, whether it be a minute, 3 minutes, whatever it is, and then you're done, you move on to the next task of the night. Pajamas, bedtime, bath time, and you just skip the brushing of the teeth. This didn't happen tonight. I'm not running after you. I don't have the patience for that, the timing. We're just moving on. Well, guess who thinks they won? Their child thinks they won because they didn't have to brush their teeth. Well, guess what tomorrow happens in their lunch or when they come home from school or whatever, and they ask for their regular snack, whatever they normally would get, and you say with empathy, I'd love to give you your snacks. But remember last night we weren't able to brush your teeth, and I'm afraid if you don't brush your teeth, you're going to get cavities, so I can't give you the snack today. Guess what your child's going to say? I'll brush my teeth tonight. And your response to that is, I know, I'm sure you will. End of the story, but there's no snack then because they didn't brush their teeth last night. How could they have a snack? Now, is that a punishment or a consequence? It's a consequence. If you were to say, because you didn't brush your teeth tonight, I'm not reading you books. What does that have to do with anything?
But we don't give sweets.
Okay, so then I'm saying, fine.
What would be the natural?
You don't need to give like any sort of sweet.
A hard fruit.
Yeah, we give them fruit tops.
Fruit?
No. Well, you find something, in other words, that makes sense to say. And again, there I have found in using these tools, when it's appropriate, very successful. It doesn't make parenting easier because you still have to find. You have to be thinking about the right, appropriate kind of. Let me just throw, I know there's some questions. Let me just throw a couple more to give a bigger picture. I have same thing. This is where it sometimes is harsh, and there are more harsh and less harsh places to use it. And I want to throw out a bunch of different examples, and you see what works for you as a parent and what doesn't work for you as a parent. So in one of the harsher examples that I've used, but it works, is the dinner time example that I started mentioning before. Time for dinner. Now, the reason why I had to revert to the harsher application of this is because dinner time had become a disaster. Kanai and Hara had a bunch of little kids, and it was lasting forever. Nobody was coming, and it was like a three-hour ordeal, which we didn't have the ability to manage. So we simply set a very simple policy. Dinner went onto the table, and the kids were in the playroom, and we said, dinner is being served. It's being served for the next 25 minutes. It's now 6 o'clock, whatever time it was. At 6:25, dinner is being put away.
Kitchen is closed. Right.
Is there? Well, guess who comes to the kitchen? Nobody. Nobody. Now, being the not so ruthless parent, at 6:10, I said dinner is being served. I poked my head in. Dinner is being served for 15 more minutes. And then at 6:20, I said dinner is being served for 5 minutes. One or two came. Some didn't. I had one child who didn't come. And it was fine. Those who ate, 6:25 comes, and the kitchen is closed. At about 6:45, the said child who had not come in during the time comes into the kitchen. Oh, I'm starving! And with great empathy, we said, oh, I'm so sorry. I hate it when I'm starving. The kitchen's already closed. Oh, and then you get the regular, I'm starving, I'm so hungry. I feel so bad. I hate going to bed when I'm hungry. The kitchen's closed already. And you don't lecture about, remember I told you at 6, none of that stuff. None of that. Not necessary. Kitchen is closed. They will throw a temper tantrum, which you then revert back to step B, in which you can cry in your room all you want about being hungry, and you could be so, and you have, if you're angry at them, or you're like vengeful, you honestly feel bad for them. My children still talk about the one night where one of the children went to sleep without dinner, and I'm okay with that. And we don't have a problem. It's now, as they get older, it becomes less of a problem, but that is a non, they know when we say the kitchen's closing in 25 minutes, kitchen's actually closing, and they come. There are no fights. If they choose not to eat that night, which I have had many children who do, and then don't come back later and complain, they just choose not to eat. Okay, no child is going to like wither away and disappear if they don't eat dinner for a night. When they're hungry, they'll eat. They might not sleep, and then we'll go into how to handle the sleep patterns. That's true. Yeah, okay, let me just... That's the general theory. I want to go through a bunch of examples. I have another bunch of questions. Let's tackle some of the questions, and then we can work from there. Did someone...
How
old? How old?
16 months.
16 months. They understand.
He hits his head against the wall. Hits his brother. He doesn't understand, and I don't know how to. I'm watching his brother get hit. Like, okay, I'm trying not.
He
to
does. So he's removed from the arena.
Just remove him.
Totally. No, at that age, as soon as he hits, you don't need to say anything. Just pick him up and put him in his. At that age, put him in his crib.
Put him in his crib.
And then you take him out. And
what's the normal amount of time for a
minute. He doesn't need more than a minute. It's not a punishment. It's that when you hit, you can't be in the arena.
Right.
It's literally a minute.
Even a temper tantrum.
Totally.
On all fours.
Yeah.
It's really funny, but I try not to laugh. But I usually ignore it, but you're saying take him out.
Take him out and say, like, this can't take place here. In other words, he's not going to get the attention that he wants. You can't ignore it also. Sometimes you have to because you got another baby. I'm like trying to feed this child. I got dinner on this. You have to. But so there's certainly not gonna, but the easiest thing and the best thing is simply to remove him and then bring him back.
Because I can't say anything. Okay, now we're dinner.
Yeah, of course not. They don't. I had a parent in shul who I was talking to during Kiddush who had a less than 2-year-old. And the parent is, the father's holding his little girl. And as the father's holding the girl, she's slapping his cheek. So he's embarrassed. He's sitting in front of me, and she's slapping him. So what does he do? He starts talking to her. Dad, you can't hit Daddy. No, you can't hit Daddy. You can't. I'm like, I said, put her down. So he puts her down, and she says, you can't hit Daddy. She picks her up, and that's the end of it. It's that, like, children don't understand the words. They understand the response. It's just a behavior modification. Now again, I like that. Well, we spoke of last week is all about words and feelings. That's what, I think they're both true. Like, I find the, like, love and logic doesn't tell you what to do when your kid comes to you with a painting and says, what do you think? There's nothing in love and logic that, I don't know. It's a behavior modification system. But when you learn to talk in a loving, positive way, and when then there are behaviors that you don't know how to handle, I find love a lot. As much as they say it'll teach children responsibility, which it might. I hope my children are growing up responsible. What it helps me is I know what I'm doing in every situation. I know I can't control the behavior. Fine, I'm going to come up with a consequence that makes sense.
Basically, have a plan, so you're not.
I have a plan. Because remember, we spoke about the pilot in the airplane last week, those who weren't here. Right? If you're in an airplane and the pilot gets on and says, there's a red flashing light, I don't know what it means, it's crazy. Right? You go crazy. So when you respond the way to your children, in which they're giving you trouble and you're getting all clustered, they respond, I'm totally calm. And as much as B.J. Skinner held that you have to have immediate responses, children have fabulous memory. Anyone's 18-month-old know where you keep the cookies in your cabinet? They remember a lot of things. So they'll remember that the next morning they didn't get a cookie because they didn't brush their teeth. They'll remember. They know those things. They pick up on the behavior much more than anything else. I've had, again, with older children in terms of going to school in the morning. So this is the time we leave for school. And if you're not ready, I'm leaving for school. And again, I can do this because my wife is still home with the two little ones when I take the bigger ones to school. So you have to know what works and what doesn't work. It works for me to leave a child behind. And then when I take the little ones to school, an hour later I take that one, and they come an hour late to school, which most children actually don't like. And if your children like that, then it's not such a good thing. But generally, at a younger age, they don't like that. But they're not going to control the whole carpool. I got 4 other kids going to school. I got my neighbor's kids and these kids. We're leaving at this and this time. And if they're not out, they know that that's it. We're actually leaving. It's not a punishment. It's just you got to be on time. Life requires you to get your stuff together and get on time. Now, this is where love and logic and, like, favorite magic would butt heads when you talk about a child who left their homework assignment on the kitchen table. Mm-hmm. And you see it there, and they go off to school. Now, what do you do? So love and logic would say, don't you dare bring that paper to school. Mm-hmm. Because this is such a valuable lesson to teach your child at a young age where the cost is going to be relatively minor, that if you don't check your bag and make sure you have what you need, You're going to suffer the consequences. What are the consequences? In school, something's going to happen to them. Well, the logic would say, what a fabulous learning opportunity. When they call and they ask you to bring it, and you're empathic and you feel so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm just not available to bring it. I can't. I wish I could. I can't. That's what love and logic would tell you to do in that scenario, and let the consequence teach the child. Let the lesson be learned. They forgot it, and they're going to suffer the consequence. They forgot their baseball glove. They're not going to have it. You're not going to spend your life running around town back and forth because they forgot their stuff. Because you can't spend your whole life doing that. Believe me, once you get enough children who are busy playing sports and going to school, you'll spend your whole life running after them, picking up the stuff, versus allowing them to suffer the consequence of not having their cleats at one soccer game, and problem solved. Now, a lot of parents, some that I know very well, can't handle that. Cannot handle having the paper, and they'll bring it, and they'll deal with level logic in other areas. And again, as I said, it's a tool. If it works for you under certain circumstances, that's great. And if it doesn't, that's also fine. But it is an approach of, I can't force a behavior. I can only deal with consequences. Let's go through the examples that I have here in letter G. Are we holding timing wise? Oh my. Let's go through this quickly. And I'll let you go. And B, grabbing a child's swinging. Let's take the last one. Swinging a yo-yo. I had this situation where a three-year-old is swinging a yo-yo. Now, he doesn't realize how dangerous it is, but there are other children around whose heads are like inches away from this yo-yo being swung on. And you're the parent and you see that. What's your response? Right? You can yell at the child, you could lecture the child about the dangers of swinging a yo-yo, or you could simply remove the yo-yo and then give it back 30 seconds later and say, yo-yos aren't for swinging, are you ready to try again? Child will say yes, and you'll find, more often than not, that they got it. Just because of the actions, the behavior. Getting dressed is a great one. Child won't get dressed. Now, whether or not it's at nighttime into pajamas or it's getting dressed in the morning. Pajamas is the thing. Let's say you got the diaper on. You got that, now they're giving you a hard time with the pajamas. So you're trying to get them on and they're squiggling around. What do you do as a parent? Right, hold them down. I've tried that a lot. How does that go for you?
Not well.
Right, not well. What should you do? Leave. Done. Either put in the bed in a diaper, or I just leave. I literally, like, I'm struggling with them. I'm not going to get frustrated. I'm done. We'll continue the night another 2 minutes, and we're going to skip pajamas, and we're going to put in a diaper. It doesn't bother me. Most children I can play that I have, actually, when I get up and leave, come running after me and say, I'm ready. Because they want their pajamas, they were just being whatever they were being. But I'm not going to engage it. I'm not interested. So I leave. And if they don't want their pajamas that night, it's okay with me. What's the natural consequence of going to sleep without your pajamas? Okay. So if they like it, great. I know a lot of adults who like to sleep without lots of clothing on because they're warm. If your child likes that, if children feel cold, then guess what? The next night when they start, or even that night when they start saying, I don't want my pajamas, I would simply say, you give them, are you ready now? And if they're ready, yes. But as soon as they start fidgeting, you're done. I'm not going to fight with you. I will walk away, and I'll give you another opportunity in a few minutes, and if you're ready, great. And if you're not, I don't need to punish you. The natural consequence is you go to sleep without a diaper. This works in the morning, too. You're trying to get your child dressed to go to school, and they're giving you a hard time, and you stop getting them dressed. Done. And then you just continue the routine, pack their lunch, get their bag, and just get them ready, put on the coat, take them outside, and be like, I'm not dressed. And you're like, I know. Do you as a parent have a problem sending your child to preschool in pajamas? I don't know. If you do, then this won't work. But I would tell you to do it once, because children who are old enough to go to preschool and are not little infants don't like being in pajamas.
That's when the breakdown will start as soon as you're walking.
So you need to know that we didn't get them dressed yet, but I'm not going to fight with them. I'm ready to take them. So leave a minute or two earlier, and they'll get it. That's all where, you know, you need to know your circumstance, whether or not you have somebody else at home, you don't, you need to get them out of the house. But I'm not going to fight to get you dressed, so we'll go to school not dressed. There's no punishment needed here. They'll make the decision. Maybe they'll go to bed. They'll go to school in pajamas. And if you find that you have a child who likes going to school in pajamas, right, I guarantee, in the same way as no one walks down the aisle sucking their thumb, they'll grow out of it. Your child will grow out of their pajamas. By the time they get to kindergarten, for sure, There is no way they're going to school in pajamas.
Almost through second grade.
Okay, and let's say you have an exception like that. Is it a problem that you have a child who wants to go to school in pajamas?
Not for me, for the teacher.
Perfect. Let's examine. As a parent, let's say I had such a child, I would agree with you. It doesn't bother me. Who does it bother? Teacher. You never need to be the bad guy if somebody else is. Now, I say it as a joke. I mean it for real. Yeah. Your child comes home and says something along the lines of, basketball practice is so stupid, I never want to go again. So you can favor Maslow Shlem and say, I hear a boy who's so angry, upset, or frustrated, whatever you want to do that. But you don't need to say, if you don't go to practice, you're not going to be able to play. Because who's going to say that to them?
The coach.
You don't have to be the one to say that. Why don't you say, you really don't like going to practice. That's tough. I hear it frustrating. Why don't you ask the coach if you can still play and not go to practice? So that you're on the child's side. Yeah, I hear that's totally frustrating. I know you don't want to go. Why don't you ask your coach if you could just come to the games? Now, I know the answer to that question, but why do I have to be the one to tell my child that? Let the coach, whose job it is to do that. So you have a child, the teacher has a problem with it.
Focus on all the other kids come to school in pajamas.
Excellent, which is fine. So here, let's take this as a classic example. Most children will, at a very young age, say, wait, you're leaving, I'm not dressed. I want to get dressed, I'm ready. And they'll be done. But you have an exceptional child in many different ways, and they'll say, I don't mind. Fine, I don't mind. So you know what? Take this away. Well, what's the problem? The teacher says, you can't go to school in your pajamas. So you take the child to school and you put the clothing in a bag, mm-hmm. and you call the preschool director and you say, my child is, going to be coming in pajamas and will be in the director's office until she's ready to get dressed because the teacher doesn't allow it. So you're on the child's side. You're like, no problem. Here, let's pack your clothing. And you're on their side. We'll take them to school. And when you get there and you can work this out in advance with the teacher, and the child will not. And again, let the school deal with that. And then the child is not going to want to sit generally in, wherever. The school can create an environment where the child's really not excited to be there.
Right.
And we'll get dressed on their own. You don't have to fight that fight because the child will want to get dressed on their own. Let them go in their pajamas. Most children on their own right away want to do that.
We've talked a lot about negative behavior where we're trying to get them to do something differently.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get into it maybe next time on conditioning for positive, reinforcing positive behaviors.
Well,
they did what I wanted them to do.
That goes back to what we spoke about last week in the sense of how you respond and describe what it is that they did. A lot of that's why I present this. I find this method is a behavior modification method of child's not behaving the way you want. Well, threats don't work. Anger doesn't work. Lectures don't work. So let their actions teach. Let them choose. Let them behave the way that they want to behave. Let me just say one or two examples, and I'll let you go. I know it's getting late. I have a child's not starting homework as they're getting older now. At the time that you want them to start, or that they need to start. So what are our options? It's homework time and they're not getting started. So we can yell, force, scream, we can do all sorts of things, which has the success rate of very low. So what's the other option?
Homework time is over.
Exactly. Homework time is over. Bedtime is 8:30, 8 o'clock, whatever time it is. 20 minutes before that, we have to start taking baths. Homework time is over at 8 o'clock. I'm happy to help you till then, and then homework is done. And if the child is the kind of child who is like many adults that I know, will start at 7:45 and get it done, great. Why do I need to force my child to work for... And if they start at 7:50 and they don't get it done, great. At 8 o'clock, homework time is done. And you say, I'll be happy to write a note to your teacher that you got started at 7:50 and you weren't able to be done. And let the teacher deal with the child, suffer the consequence of what it's like not getting them. But there's a end time of when it is. And you don't have to fight with your child to sit down and do homework because you can't. It's a exhausting, fruitless exercise of getting a child to start. You're just going to control the system as to here's when homework starts. Here's when it's done. I'm available to help you. And at this point, it's over. I had a third grader who had a project due as 2 weeks. Didn't do it. The night before it's due, procrastinating, said at 8:45, I gave him a half hour more than his usual bedtime. At 8:45, it's lights out wherever you're up to. And I walked away from it. And he sat down, and he got a little bit done, and he realized he was never going to finish, and he started crying.
Oh my gosh.
And I sat down with him. And I said, so I know it's so frustrating when you think you're never going to get it done. You're not going to have enough time. And I didn't have to lecture him and say, you had this project for 2 weeks. I didn't do that. He's getting it without me. I'm on his side. I just feel bad for him that he's never going to get it done. And then Faber-Maslach, trying to get in there with him. I help. Well, let's see however much we can get done. Didn't lecture, didn't yell at him, didn't point out. I just worked it. Let's see how much we can get done. And he got down to it, and he finished at 8:45. Whatever it is that he needed to do. Was it perfect? No. But was it the way that he wanted? It wasn't perfect. But he got the experience. And if it worked for him, so then I can't teach him more about doing things early, other than he's got to live his life. And if he got it done, he got it done. And if he doesn't get it done, which more often happens, he won't.
So if you're helping him to do it,
yeah. Only until 8:45. I'm willing to help. That's what I said in the beginning. I'm willing to help you from 6 to 8:45.
Isn't that teaching him that if he puts it off long enough, his parents are going to bail him out?
No, because at 8:45, it's done.
Like you helped him, then you would have helped.
He was going to help many other nights, too.
Right.
That was the boundary.
Meaning that if he hadn't finished at 8:45, he's going to bed, and I'm not finishing it for him. He's taking it to school unfinished. So,
were you offering to help him other nights also to do it?
Yeah, well, he had plenty of opportunities. He just wasn't interested in doing it, which is fine. Most adults are like that too, right?
Do you have any recommendations for children who just don't like it? And, I mean, this is what you were saying about the wash hands. We know they don't wash their hands, but saying to them they won't be able to eat is like, whatever. Or calling them to the table and saying, I'm going to close the kitchen.
Because they don't care.
They're skinny. They're falling off the skinny charts that the doctor wanted. And if I don't see...
I have a child like that.
And we're in a cycle of, like, stress them with the video, get the spoonfuls in, and, you know...
So that's where a lot of...
...typically knows how to do everything on his own, but we're still feeding him. And if it comes with the lunches... and then when he comes home, I make him eat the lunch that he didn't eat at school.
So there's at some point you'll be able to find, and this is what we've basically discovered, where there's something that he can only do after he eats. In other words, if a child who doesn't eat their lunch can't play on, you name it. Like when you come home from school, children who have eaten lunch can come up with any exercise that you want that makes sense, like, well, after you've taken care of what you need to do, or dinner, whatever it is, and then it's fine. And if they don't, you'll find something that will inspire them enough to want, and if you can't really force the eating, but the best thing is to give them something where they, on their own, come to the conclusion that it's worthwhile for them to eat, because, again, not as a punishment, but just as a, like, and it's like, children, I can't have a child playing on the computer if you haven't eaten supper yet. That doesn't work in my house. So that's sort of like, the kids get that, that makes sense. Like, you can't play until you take everything to take care of. You don't want to play on the computer tonight? All right, then I'll try to find other things that you know, but that's how I would, try to address that.
I want to ask you about implementation. There are certainly things that we're definitely doing wrong, and how are you supposed to just switch on the dime and start these wonderful new ideas?
With a lot of empathy. Yeah, so that's the hardest part. In other words, I experienced that with my first two children where I was unaware of any of these things, and I did a lot of threatening and yelling, and then I realized that this was just very unhappy parenting, and I came across these other things. The beginning is much more difficult. All these situations that you came up with, they're going to keep coming out, they're going to keep yelling, that will happen. And as long as you are consistent, I'm going to let you go, it's really late, I'm sorry, it's right at 9:20. We'll talk more about this next week. As long as you're consistent and calm, you can outlast them and teach them that you mean it and that you're not giving in. I'll leave you with this one last thought, and then we'll go. When you're inconsistent, I call it slot machine parenting. Did I mention this last week? I don't think so. Slot machine parenting is one of the greatest crimes against our children that a parent can do. What a slot machine, the way that a slot machine works is, for those of you who have never been in a casino, so there's this little machine, and you put in a dollar, and you pull the lever, and the different things come up. Now, they're all rigged. They're all rigged to win every once in a while. There's no skill involved. You just keep doing it, and eventually they win. Now, why are they rigged to win? Because they want all the other people who go there to play the machines to hear the sirens going off all over the place. So they know that they're going to win eventually, and they keep playing. So you put in a couple of bucks, $10, and you don't win. Now, what do you think at that point? Well, I can either stop down and cut my losses, but most likely, I've already done it 10 times. Probably I'm really close to the big payoff. So you put in another dollar, and now you're even farther. Didn't win. So you can cut your losses, but most likely you're going to say to yourself, I'm even closer now. I should stop now and allow the next guy who's going to come, he's going to put in $1 and he's going to win. I need to keep going. Because I know at some point I'm going to win. I know it. And you're right. That's the mentality, the psychology behind the slot machine. The player knows eventually if he keeps at it, he'll get it. And it's impossible to stop when you know that. If you would start playing a slot machine, I'd come over and say, you know, I happen to know this machine. They set this one up. It never wins. Mm-hmm. It never wins. Would you put another dollar in there? Why would you? You just told me that this particular machine, it never, ever wins. So as a parent, your child says, I want candy. So you say, no, I'm sorry, it's right before supper, we can't have candy. You say, really sweet. And they say, I want candy. And you say, really sweet, maybe a little less sweet. Oh, well, you can't now because we're going to have dinner in a minute. And then they drop on the floor and they say, no, I want it, I want it, I want it, I want it. The worst torture, child abuse, that you can do is say, okay, fine. Child abuse. It is child abuse. If I catch you doing it, I'll call defects on you. Because you are creating a whiny child who thinks, not maliciously, who learns from the world around them. Do you know how the world works? When you want something, if you ask for it enough, 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 you'll get it. But you have no idea how many times you have to ask. You don't know if you have to ask 10 times, or 12, or 20, if you have to scream this amount, but I know I'll get it, because that's how the world works. Not maliciously, you've taught your child, this is how the world works. Keep on asking it, you'll get it. You will see a whiny child who doesn't know how to ever stop, because you've taught them, don't stop. If we'll be consistent in these first stages, when you're starting this new routine, and it's going to be a new system, but it's consistent. When this is the policy, this is the way that things work, it doesn't change. And in my house, you'll hear the phrase many times, I've already said no, please don't ask again. And we mean it. No is no. So it's as if you tell a person in a casino, that machine will never, ever give out a winner. Why would I ask again? Why would I? It's done. They ask once, twice, which is normal for children. Say, we already said no, we're not discussing this anymore. And it's the end. And I can't, like when I see that parent just like they're at their wit's end and they say, okay, fine. Like, no, 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 now you're going to get it again tomorrow and next week because you've taught your child this is how the world works. It's horrible.
I have
yeah.
To change that.
You have the choice when you want to say no, but if you said no, mm-hmm. then it's no. You don't have to say no to giving them candy. But if you said no, then it's no. If you said we're not going to this and this place, if you said whatever you said, and they keep asking, which is that's what they're going to do, it has to be firm. We said no. I don't want to, we're not talking about this anymore.
You can go back to last week and say you can have candy.
Right. When. You can give them when they can have the candy. You can say we can have candy after dinner. But if whatever the circumstances where the answer to their request was no, it has to be no, so that they learn when mommy or daddy says no, it means no. They can ask a second time. You could say I answered it. After the third time, we're not discussing this anymore, and it's just end of the story. Okay, I don't want to keep you guys anymore. It's late. I'm happy to stay for those of you who have questions. We'll talk about this more next week. I want to go through more examples as children get older and talk about this more. I try it out. Give me some feedback. Tell me how it went, and we'll tie it all in Mirtz Hashem next week.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.